you're listening to Truth News Radio Australia, and it is the 26th of September 2012, and I'm your host, Herewood Fenton. Welcome to another show. Currently I'm broadcasting from Thailand. I'm having a bit of R&R and doing a bit of work at the same time. And unfortunately, I've been having a few problems with my internet connection. So the show today is going to be largely me talking without any guests, but I'm going to try and get into some subjects that I find extremely interesting and some that have been weighing on my mind. And at the top of the list, I have this question in my mind, which I want to present to you, and I want to step us through some attempts at a solution. And the question is central to the actual theme of this show. The question is, what is truth? Now, it may seem like an obvious one. It may seem like, well, the truth is just what really happened. That's what a lot of people would probably say. There is nothing ambiguous here. It's just the truth is what really happened, what really is, and that which is not true, of course, is not true. Seems pretty straightforward as long as you don't dig into it too deeply. But in my experience, and particularly doing this show, I've come to realize that the truth is not something as simple and as obvious as I had believed throughout my life. Now, this, of course, is a somewhat philosophical question, but we overlook it at our peril, especially when we set ourselves the task of finding out what is true, and especially when we're looking into areas that have been clouded by misdirection, misinformation, disinformation, by people's prejudices, by so many factors, psychological and ideological, that the nature of reality is masked. So I want to get into that deeper question. I also want to run through a few of the top stories for this week, and I want to play a few clips that will perhaps illustrate some of the themes that I'm talking about in today's show. So please sit back, grab yourself a mug of hot beverage of any kind, and sit back and enjoy the show. Now, the first thing I would like to look at in our consideration of the meaning of truth itself is to have a look at some of the philosophical discourse on this topic. Of course, it is a massive topic, and the philosophy and the people who've looked at it go back many thousands of years. And really, we could spend years simply trying to study and understand what we even mean by the word truth. But I'm going to cut to the chase, and I'm going to start by giving you a little quote from one of the giants of modern philosophy, Immanuel Kant. And here is a direct quote from Kant's Critique of Pure Reason. "Truth, it is said, consists in the agreement of cognition with its object. In consequence of this mere nominal definition, my cognition, to count as true, is supposed to agree with its object. Now, I can compare the object with my cognition, however, only by cognizing it. Hence, my cognition is supposed to confirm itself, which is far short of being sufficient for truth. For since the object is outside me, the cognition in me, all I can ever pass judgment on is whether my cognition of the object agrees with my cognition of the object." Now, I just want to pause there and give you a chance to really absorb the magnitude of the statement I just read. And I encourage you to rewind and play it again a couple of times, because it really does throw a giant spanner in the works of our common sense notions of what truth is and of our ability to know truly what anything is. What Kant is saying here is that every cognition we have is within the medium of consciousness, and there is nothing outside of that that we can refer to get an objective correlation from. So when we talk about our observations corresponding with reality, well, the only reality that we can ever know is the reality that we cognize. So it is really just cognitions corresponding with other cognitions. That's all we have to go on. Now, the philosophical position that Kant is expressing here is known as nominalism. And it is actually quite an ancient philosophical position which says that our knowledge of reality is simply our knowledge of the words or meanings we give to things rather than of the absolute reality behind them. The idea that we could actually know the absolute reality behind things is known as realism. And these two trends of nominalism and realism in philosophical thought have a very long pedigree. And I believe it is absolutely central to, I guess, the quest of Truth News and all of the other great websites and alternative news sources out there that are trying to penetrate through the obfuscating layers of deception in our world. It is absolutely central to all that, this deep philosophical dialogue and somewhat a dispute over the fundamentals of nominalism versus realism. And when we refer to dystopic writing such as those of George Orwell, we actually see Orwell reaching into the history of philosophy to give us a concept of how society might be modelled on a concept of consciousness and truth, which says, well, all of reality is merely known via, as Kant said, via the cognition of it through a nominalist paradigm. And if you change the way people think, you will change the reality. And so to put that into practice with the aids of propaganda and mind control using a variety of techniques, it would certainly be quite possible to completely shape a reality, and it would meet the requirements of Kant's definition of truth, because the cognitions of those who perceived it would match up. Now, since we've broached the subject of George Orwell, I'd like to continue with a reading from an essay by George Orwell, which was written in 1944, just towards the end of the Second World War. And the title of the essay is Historical Truth. And this essay actually really makes some very interesting points. And if you consider the time in history that it was written, and George Orwell grappling with this concept, and this is, of course, several years before he wrote 1984. So quoting now from George Orwell's essay. Up to a fairly recent date, the major events recorded in the history books probably happened. It is probably true that the Battle of Hastings was fought in 1066, that Columbus discovered America, and that Henry VIII had six wives, and so on. A certain degree of truthfulness was possible, so long as it was admitted that a fact may be true, even if you don't like it. Even as late as the last war, and of course here he's referring to the First World War, even as late as the last war, it was possible for the Encyclopaedia Britannica, for instance, to compile its articles on the various campaigns partly from German sources. Some of the facts, the casualty figures, for instance, were regarded as neutral and in substance accepted by everybody. No such thing would be possible now. A Nazi and a non-Nazi version of the present war would have no resemblance to one another, and which of them finally gets into the history books will be decided not by evidential methods, but on the battlefield. During the Spanish Civil War, I found myself feeling very strongly that a true history of this war never would or could be written. Accurate figures, objective accounts of what was happening simply did not exist. And if I felt that in 1937, when the Spanish government was still in being, and the lies which the various Republican factions were telling us about each other and about the enemy were relatively small ones, how does that stand now? Even if Franco is overthrown, what kinds of records will the future historian have to go upon? And if Franco, or anyone at all resembling him, remains in power, the history of the war will consist quite largely of facts which millions of people now living know to be lies. One of these facts, for instance, is that there was a considerable Russian army in Spain. There exists the most abundant evidence that there was no such army. Yet if Franco remains in power, and if fascism in general survives, that Russian army will go into the history books and future schoolchildren will believe in it. So for practical purposes, the lie will have become truth. This kind of thing is happening all the time. Out of the millions of instances which must be available, I will choose one which happens to be verifiable. During part of 1941 and 1942, when the Luftwaffe was busy in Russia, the German radio regaled its home audiences with stories of devastating air raids on London. Now, we are aware that those raids did not happen. But what use would our knowledge be if the Germans conquered Britain? For the purposes of a future discussion, did those raids happen or didn't they? The answer is, if Hitler survives, they happened. And if he falls, they didn't happen. So with innumerable other events of the past 10 or 20 years. Is the Protocols of the Elders of Zion a genuine document? Did Trotsky plot with the Nazis? How many German aeroplanes were shot down in the Battle of Britain? Does Europe welcome the new order? In no case do you get one answer which is universally accepted because it is true. In each case, you get a number of totally incompatible answers, one of which is finally adopted as a result of a physical struggle. History is written by the winners. Now, of course, hearing me say that, you're probably thinking, well, we already knew that. It's a commonplace. It's often said, you know, history is written by the winners, and we all have a good chuckle, and we think, you know, we think we're pretty smug because we sort of think we understand it. But our own histories have been written by those who consider themselves to be winners, and they weren't necessarily our friends. They were just the people who consider themselves to be the winners. You're with Truth News Radio Australia. We'll be right back after this break. Do stay with us. Are you getting fed up with all the disinformation, deception, spin, propaganda, half-truths and downright lies in mainstream news? Looking for something different? Visit Truth News Radio Australia. www.truthnews.com.au, and may the truth set you free. Welcome back. You're listening to Truth News Radio Australia. It's great to have you company today. I was just running through some quotes there from George Orwell in our discussion of truth and trying to get into the nitty-gritty of what truth is. And I'd just like to reflect a little bit on what we were saying there in the previous section. The way in which given truth in the modern era is manipulated, even according to Orwell, and this is, of course, 60, 70 years ago now, has increased. Whereas going back several hundred years, we have historical records that were certainly not detailed, but there was information in there that we could have some confidence in as to its veracity. But the modern era, and I believe this is partly because of the way in which the philosophical ideas, such as we were discussing earlier, have somewhat informed the techniques of the propagandists. In the modern era, reality itself has become incredibly malleable, incredibly plastic. And we were reading there from Orwell, and he was talking about how certain events in the Second World War would be rendered quite differently in historical accounts, depending on who won the war. Now, let's just fast forward to some recent events, and we've seen in the conflict in the Middle East, in Syria, we've seen indications that the West is putting forward stories about massacres that were conducted by the Syrian government. We've got other people on the ground, including the Syrian government, saying it's the complete opposite. We see the creation of a narrative about Iran building a nuclear weapon, and Iran says it's not building a nuclear weapon. But there are these alternate narratives of reality, and depending on who wins the conflicts that we're in now, one or another narrative will become what is true for people. And of course, we might refer to 9/11, the narrative there of 19 hijackers directed by a fanatic from a cave in Afghanistan. And that event, of course, the collapse of the towers, is seen to be the objective reality by many people. But again, if times change, and believe me, times are changing, that narrative may in the end be overturned, and some of the alternate views that we've already put forward on this show may end up becoming the real, the true. But will we ever really know what happened? Let's talk about, for example, the landings on the moon, the Apollo moon landings. And this is a great example of trying to see what we can really know. What we have given is information, which is provided by sources from media and government that say the Americans landed about 12 astronauts on the moon, and they've provided photographic records, and the media certainly reinforces that. And so we have the fairly solid construction of a reality there that says that, yes, indeed, human beings did go to the moon. But then, of course, there's been this alternate narrative over the last 40 years of people questioning that and saying, well, these sources of information you provide are arbitrary, they're limited. There's only certain sources of information, and the information you provided does not correspond with other things that we know, such as the Van Allen radiation belts, and you never explained how they could have basically dealt with such things as the radiation. And there has never been an explanation for why there were no subsequent missions to the moon after about 1972. It all stopped. And again, that doesn't correspond well with the purported reality of people going to the moon. But you know, there's two narratives there, and we are deeply confounded by our inability to know which narrative is true, if any of them. Maybe the truth is somewhere in between. And indeed, with the various theories of what happened on September 11, maybe the truth of what happened is somewhere in between. But then again, maybe the truth of the objective reality, the external reality, is unknowable if Immanuel Kant is right, and that all we will ever have are these cognitions and narratives that we create, and we basically are stuck with that. And, you know, there's something a little bit, I find a little bit saddening about that, a little bit demoralizing, because I do have a sense that I do know certain things, and I feel that some of those really important things can be known as well. But given the difficulty of it, and given the difficulty even with some of the more ordinary day-to-day things, I mean, if you try to remember exactly what you did on a given day, and, you know, we've seen it in court cases, witness identifications often prove to be faulty. People's memories are not reliable, and, you know, indeed, why should they be? People's memories are affected by all kinds of factors. Now, I'm going to throw another spanner into the works of the whole question of what we know and how we can know by considering another type of philosophical debate, which is kind of off to the left field from the one we were talking about before with Immanuel Kant, which the one with Kant there about nominalism versus realism is a very deep one. It's very metaphysical. It's very ancient. But a more recent debate, which is intrinsic to the development of science, is the debate between rationalism and empiricism. And I want to actually quote to you from an essay here that I've picked from the Stanford Encyclopedia of Philosophy, Rationalism versus Empiricism. Now, empiricism is largely associated with people such as Bacon and John Locke, who were the fathers of the modern scientific method. So here from the essay from the Stanford Encyclopedia, the dispute between rationalism and empiricism concerns the extent to which we are dependent upon sense experience in our effort to gain knowledge. Rationalists claim that there are significant ways in which our concepts and knowledge are gained independently of sense experience. Empiricists claim that sense experience is the ultimate source of all our concepts and knowledge. Rationalists generally developed their views in two ways. First, they argue that there are cases where the content of our concepts or knowledge outstrips the information that sense experience can provide. Second, they construct accounts of how reason, in some form or other, provides that additional information about the world. Empiricists present complementary lines of thought. First, they develop accounts of how experience provides the information that rationalists cite, insofar as we have it in the first place. Empiricists will at times opt for skepticism as an alternative to rationalism. If experience cannot provide the concepts or knowledge that rationalists cite, then we don't have them. Second, empiricists lack the rationalist accounts of how reason is a source of concepts of knowledge. The dispute between rationalism and empiricism takes place within epistemology, the branch of philosophy devoted to studying the nature, sources, and limits of knowledge. We're just going to break, and I'll continue with this essay after we return. You're with Truth News Radio Australia. Please stay with us.
To go before you reach all your selfish punchline, left a punchline, leaving us all.
Hi, welcome back. You're tuned to Truth News Radio Australia. And of course, you can find our website and podcasts on the internet. If you just Google Truth News Australia or Truth News Radio, it will come up and you can find the RSS feed links there and you can get the show on your smartphone. You can use one of the podcasting apps on your smartphone and you can get it delivered to your phone regularly, which is probably the best way to get the show. And you know, just have a look at the site, www.truthnews.com.au, and join our Facebook fan page if you're interested. Now, I'm just going to continue here with the essay I was reading from before, and this is about the philosophical debate between rationalism versus empiricism. And this is quite an interesting subject again for some of the questions we were discussing earlier, but I'm going to just read to you some of this and then I'm going to get into kind of analyzing it and applying it in a concrete way if I can. The dispute between rationalism and empiricism takes place within epistemology, which is the branch of philosophy devoted to studying the nature, sources, and limits of knowledge. The defining questions of epistemology include the following. What is the nature of propositional knowledge? Knowledge that a particular proposition about the world is true. So that's the first question of epistemology. Second one is, how can we gain knowledge? Third question, what are the limits of our knowledge? Now, I'll just read you a few comments here from the essay here that I'm reading from. On, firstly, what is the nature of propositional knowledge? Knowing a particular proposition requires both that we believe it and that it be true. But it also clearly requires something more, something that distinguishes knowledge from a lucky guess. Let's call this additional element warrant. A good deal of philosophical work has been invested in trying to determine the nature of this additional element. Now, in relation to how we gain knowledge, we can form true beliefs just by making some lucky guesses. How can we gain warranted beliefs? However, how we do this is unclear. Moreover, to know the world, we must think about it, and it is not clear how we gain the concepts we use in thought, or what assurance, if any, we have that the ways in which we divide up the world using our concepts correspond to divisions that actually exist. Now, that, of course, hints back to this question about can we know reality again. You know, let's just stay clear of that, because that's a really scary one. For now, we'll stay clear of it. Now, in relation to the limits of knowledge, some aspects of the world may be within the limits of our thought, but beyond the limits of our knowledge. Faced with competing descriptions of them, we cannot know which description is true. Some aspects of the world may even be beyond the limits of our thought, so that we cannot even form intelligible descriptions of them, let alone know that a particular description is true. And that, of course, is a very scary problem too. When we consider the fact, as Donald Rumsfeld famously once said, there are known knowns and there are unknown knowns and there are unknown unknowns. Well, you know, the unknown unknowns, the things that you do not know that you do not know, that will lead you into areas of truth that right now you've got don't even have a comprehension of, you don't even have a word for. And yet, as we learn, as we grow, these are the kind of evolutions and transformations that will occur. So eventually you will come to know things that now you have absolutely no conception of. And of course, this experience of entering into new forms of knowledge is one which people who describe themselves as truthers have actually had. And, you know, many people who've woken up to some of the deceptions that are going on in the world, it's like they've stepped through the looking glass. They've stepped into another dimension of reality that they didn't know existed. And when those people try to communicate back through the looking glass, through to the state of mind that their peers are in, they find they can't communicate it. It's not grasped. It's not even seen. And so it's not just a question of imparting a new information. It's a question of having almost a new conceptual framework that is needed to grasp new knowledge. But to return to the central argument here between empiricism and rationalism, I want to illustrate by way of an example. And I'm actually going to give an example that is very familiar to our listeners. And I'm going to try and demonstrate how this, discord between the rationalist and the empiricist way of understanding is expressed. I want to take a look at the collapse of World Trade Building 7, which of course came down on September 11 at about 5:30 in the afternoon, and it came down in about 6.5 seconds, very, very quickly, in a manner that certainly resembles what has been described as a controlled demolition, which we have seen many times on television. Now, why am I referring to this in the question of empiricism versus rationalism? Well, it's very interesting, you see, because when you look at the collapse of World Trade 7 from a purely empirical point of view, all you can do is observe what occurs. Well, the building collapses, right? That's what you have to observe. But those who have claimed to know what occurred at a deeper level are not merely referring to the visual evidence, although they are citing theories which correspond to it, but they are also referring to a deeper level of understanding. And this, I believe, is intrinsic to the distinction between a rationalist approach and an empiricist approach. And if you think I'm wrong in what I'm saying, please let me know and email me and we can debate that in future. But I think that it's very important to understand that from a purely empirical point of view, all we can say is, well, the building came down. And we can time it, we can observe it, we can measure it, we can do a whole lot of things, but we can't say from looking at it how it came down. And empiricism doesn't generally tell you how things occur. It merely makes observations. And the scientific method is really just a series of hypotheses, observations, and hypotheses. And the whole edifice of science is merely built up on these essentially predictions, which have been kind of verified and given a sense of solidity because those predictions are matched by realities. So we call it knowledge. But in fact, it's not knowledge in the sense that most people understand knowledge to be. It is merely a correspondence. It is a system of correspondences such that we can predict likely outcomes and we can plan for the future because we're able to predict likely outcomes. Now, getting back to the collapse of World Trade Building 7, the US government and a number of scientists got together and did a study which took several years, and they produced a big fat book. And in that book, they have said that the building collapsed due to fire, and the critical loss of one support column caused a weakening of the building, and an unusual sequence of events occurred. There is some interesting terminology they use. They actually use the phrase a rare event, which I'm not sure has any clear, rigorous scientific meaning. But what we are seeing here is the imposition of a rationale for why the building collapsed. Something happened that is a rare event. Something happened, a critical support failed, therefore the building came down. The official investigation into the collapse of World Trade 7 doesn't really get very deep, though, into the rationale for how the building collapsed. And I think this is a very interesting point, which I will return to after the break, because those who actually are questioning the collapse of Building 7 are far more interested in those aspects of it which we would consider to be of a rationalist slant. You're with Truth News Radio. Please stay with us. We'll be right back after this break. Welcome back. You're with Truth News Radio. Well, I'm just stumbling here through some Philosophy 101 questions and trying to apply the insights I've gained to some questions that are of particular significance and ones which we often look at on this show. And I've been looking at the collapse of World Trade Center Building Number 7. And I believe I've seen a way in which the dispute over what really occurred is somehow emblematic of the dispute between a rationalist and a purely empiricist view of events. And of course, you know, in my view, in my understanding, these rationalists, empiricists, I mean, they're both valuable and they're both useful. But as we often see in philosophical arguments and the way it's expressed, we see them as, you know, one school versus another school. But when we look at those two schools, well, we see that there are aspects of both of those schools in everything we do and think. The philosophical debate is more a question of highlighting the differences in those perspectives. But there is a problem with the purely empirical approach, despite its huge value and its great importance in science, because it does not tell us anything that is not simply an observation. And, you know, causes are not the same as observations. So when we observe Building 7 coming down very rapidly in a gravitational collapse, we can say, well, that looks like a controlled demolition. And we know how controlled demolitions are done. They're done through the use of explosives, and it takes a lot of prior preparation and intention on the part of human beings to make a building collapse in that way. But, of course, that's not part of your empirical observation. That's something else that you know from your knowledge. And you're bringing that to the subject. But, of course, we do this with everything. We have to. We bring what we know to the subject. But, of course, rationalism is a philosophical school of thought which says that there are even deeper sources of knowledge than that which is purely available through perception, that there are intuitive, intrinsic truths and realities. And this gets into a train of thought which is really beyond science. It's a question of who we are. What is the nature of our being? What are we grounded in? Are we grounded in something that is actually more than just a collection of atoms and molecules, you know, just this sort of bag of chemicals that we appear to be walking around? And pure empiricism, which is generally tied in with mechanistic positivist kind of view of the world, tends to cast the view that we are indeed simply a bag of chemicals walking around, and that there are no real causes beyond the efficient causes that make things happen at any given moment. Now, this approach of breaking everything down into pure observations is extremely useful when you're actually trying to solve technical problems of how do we do something, right? How do we send a spaceship to the moon? But, you know, they don't really satisfy. They don't satisfy much about what the human being needs in order to know what the heck's going on at any point in time. And that's when the spin masters have to come along and give you a story, give you a meaning. And, of course, we see that a lot in our modern scientific technocracy. We see spin masters coming along and giving you a nice package of narrative to make you feel that that there is something you can sort of know. But... and this is a really difficult one, and I'm getting into areas here that I have great difficulty even expressing. But the point is that there are deeper sources of cognition, in my understanding, in my view, it is my view, that there are deeper sources than simply these mere observations. And part of that is connected to questions about the motivations of human beings and what we are as people. The questions about good and evil are essential to this. Because when we look again at the collapse of World Trade 7, we know that an evil act has occurred. I mean, something terrible has occurred. The Twin Towers came down, of course, killing many thousands of people. And no matter which side of the story of 9/11 you go with, you agree that that was a very evil act that occurred, that it was done by real human beings. But then we have this question about Building 7, which is the most glaringly inconsistent part of the official narrative of 9/11. And we have observations about what occurred, which we have to bring deeper insights into in order to understand. But what I feel that is going on is that our society, guided by the media essentially, is giving us alternate ways of looking at it, alternate ways of perceiving it, to satisfy our mind. But when it's unable to do that, it's simply ignores. And we didn't really get a lot of information about World Trade 7 because it's very difficult to provide an explanation for it that is satisfying or meaningful. I mean, again, we can look at the sensory data, we can look at the data, and we see a building coming down very, very quickly indeed, in fact, imploding. But the media tells us, well, that's just what it is, and that happened, and it there is no real narrative there. Okay, that's just something that happened. Okay, they don't give you a deeper understanding of it, but your rational mind demands it. So again, to try and wrap this all up, because we are running towards the end of the hour, and I know this has been extremely inadequate, and I would love to actually spend many, many hours getting into some of the deep philosophical questions that cluster around the quest that we are on to actually find out what really happened in certain cases. We can't really know what happened. I do believe that we are in a deeply compromised position in terms of our ability to know. And we can see that there are these philosophical questions that haven't even been resolved about whether it's even possible to know absolutely, to know objective reality. We are reliant on our rational capability to be able to infer, to have insight, to construct the correct theory. And I believe that the empiricist and the rationalist positions are both extremely important. But I do believe that we need to look at physical data. We need to look at facts wherever we can define them. But we need to understand, and this is something that I think people who are conspiracy theorists often don't quite get, is that the information that they have itself does not ever prove anything about cause, about intention. The information that they have is just that. It's just data. And you can use that data in all kinds of ways constructively if you're actually trying to achieve something. But what we're actually trying to do in alternative media is we are trying to construct a picture of reality. We feel that we are being lied to. We feel that there are people who are deliberately telling lies. And not in any kind of ambiguous way either. I mean, there are people who know exactly what went down at World Trade Center 7. There are people who know, but they're keeping quiet. There are a lot of people who know that the official version of it is completely wrong, but still don't know what happened, but they're even keeping quiet about their knowledge that that's wrong. And, you know, that absence of communicating that leaves us again in a deeper position of ignorance. But the truth is just, it's a project. It's something that we're just continually reaching for and probably failing. So I hope that's been of some use and that this can allow us to reflect a little more and maybe be a little more cautious in thinking that we really know what we think we know. Hour two of today's show will be a rebroadcast. Unfortunately, I am unable to do a second hour, but I'll be rebroadcasting one of our shows from earlier this year. Please stay with us. You are with Truth News Radio Australia. It has been excellent talking to you today.